His wife, Kathy, still said she had to dress him because his taste was entirely, she said, in his mouth. But the change is sufficiently marked that even a man such as myself can see it. Thank you, Mr. President. Pat is a very good man, even for a bureau puke.
What's he doing now?
He's up in Philadelphia right now. Director Murray sent him off on a bank robbery. Two local cops got killed in that one.
Caught that one on TV last week. Bad.
The Secret Service agent nodded. The way the subjects killed the cops, both in the back of the head, that was pretty ruthless. But there's people out there like that. Anyway, Director Murray decided to handle that one with a roving inspector out of headquarters division, and that usually means Pat gets to go do it.
Tell him to be careful, Ryan said.
Inspector Pat O'Day had saved his daughter's life less than a year before, and that act had earned him undying presidential solicitude.
Every day, sir, Special Agent Price O'Day made clear.
Okay, what's the schedule look like?
His business appointments were on his desk already. Andrea Price O'Day filled him in every morning after his national security briefing from Ben Goodley. Nothing unusual until after lunch. National Chamber of Commerce delegation at 1:30, and then at 3 the Detroit Red Wings. They won the Stanley Cup this year. Photo op, TV pukes and stuff, take about 20 minutes or so.
I ought to let Ed Foley do that one. He's the hockey fanatic.
He's a Caps fan, sir. And the Red Wings swept the Caps 4 straight in the finals.
Director Foley might take it personally, Price O'Day observed with half a smile.
True. Well, last year we got the jerseys and stuff for his son, didn't we?
Yes, sir.
Good game, hockey. Maybe I ought to catch a game or two.
Trouble to arrange that?
No, sir. We have standing agreements with all the local sports facilities. Camden Yards even has that special box for us. They let us help design it, the protective stuff, that is.
Ryan grunted.
Yeah, I have to remember all the people who'd like to see me dead.
My job to think about that, sir, not yours, Price O'Day told him.
Except when you won't let me go shopping or to a movie.
Neither Ryan nor his family was entirely used to the restrictions imposed on the life of the President of the United States or his immediate family members. It was getting especially tough on Sally, who'd started dating, which was hard on her father, and dating was difficult with a lead car and a chase car, when the young gentleman drove himself, or an official car with a driver and a second armed agent up front, when he did not, and guns all over the place. It tended to restrain the young gentleman in question. And Ryan hadn't told his daughter that this was just fine with him, lest she stop speaking to him for a week or so. Sally's principal agent, Wendy Merritt, had proven to be both a good Secret Service agent and a superb big sister of sorts. They spent at least 2 Saturdays per month shopping with a reduced detail. Actually, it wasn't reduced at all, but it appeared so to Sally Ryan when they went out to Tyson's Corner or the Annapolis Mall for the purpose of spending money, something for which all women seemed to have a genetic predisposition. That these shopping expeditions had been planned days in advance, with every site scouted by the Secret Service, and a supplementary detail of young agents selected for their relative invisibility, who showed up there an hour before Shadow's arrival, had never occurred to Sally Ryan. That was just as well, as the dating problems grated on her badly enough, along with being followed around St. Mary's School in Annapolis by the Rifle Squad, as she sometimes termed it. Little Jack, on the other hand, thought it was pretty neat, and had recently learned to shoot at the Secret Service Academy in Beltsville, Maryland, with his father's permission, and something he'd not allowed the press to learn, lest he get hammered on the front page of the New York Times for the social indiscretion of encouraging his own son to touch, much less actually to fire, something so inherently evil as a pistol. Little Jack's principal agent was a kid named Mike Brennan, a South Boston Irishman,
a third-generation Secret Service agent with fiery red hair and a ready laugh, who'd played baseball at Holy Cross and frequently played catch and pepper with the president's son on the south lawn of the White House.
"Sir, we never don't let you do anything," Price said.
"No, you're pretty subtle about it," Ryan allowed. "You know that I'm too considerate of other people, and when you tell me about all the crap you people have to go through so that I can buy a burger at Wendy's, I usually back off. Like a damned wimp."
The president shook his head.
Nothing frightened him more than the prospect that he'd somehow get used to all this panoply of specialness, as he thought of it. As though he'd only recently discovered royal parentage, and was now to be treated like a king. Hardly allowed to wipe his own ass after taking a dump. Doubtless some people who'd lived in this house had gotten used to it. But that was something John Patrick Ryan Sr. wanted to avoid. He knew that he was not all that special, and not deserving of all this falderal. And besides, like every other man in the world, when he woke up in the morning, the first thing he did was head to the bathroom. Chief executive he might be, but he still had a working-class bladder. And thank God for that, the President of the United States reflected.
Where's Robbie today?
Sir, the Vice President is in California today, the Navy base at Long Beach, giving a speech at the shipyard.
Ryan grinned a little sideways.
I work him pretty hard, don't I?
That's the Vice President's job, Arnie Van Dam said from the door. And Robbie's a big boy about it, added the President's Chief of Staff.
Your vacation was good for you, Ryan observed. He had a very nice tan. What did you do?
Mainly, I laid on the beach and read all the books I haven't had time for. Thought I'd die of boredom, Van Dam added.
You actually thrive on this crap, don't you? Jack asked. A little incredulous at the thought.
It's what I do, Mr. President.
Hey, Andrea, he added with a slight turn of the head.
Good morning, Mr. Van Dam.
She turned to Jack.
That's all I have for you this morning. If you need me, I'll be in the usual place. Her office was in the old executive office building just across the street, and upstairs from the new Secret Service command post. Called JOC for Joint Operations Center.
Okay, Andrea, thanks.
Ryan nodded as she withdrew into the secretary's room, from which she'd head down to the Secret Service command post.
Arnie, get some coffee?
Not a bad idea, boss.
The chief of staff took his usual seat and poured a cup. The coffee in the White House was especially good, a rich blend. About half Colombian and half Jamaica Blue Mountain. The sort of thing that Ryan could get used to as president. There had to be some place he could buy this after escaping from his current job, he hoped.
Okay, I've had my national security brief and my Secret Service brief. Now tell me about politics for the day.
Hell, Jack, I've been trying to do that for over a year now, and you still aren't getting it very well.
Ryan allowed his eyes to flare at the simulated insult.
Well, that's a cheap shot, Arnie. I've been studying this crap pretty hard, and even the damn newspapers say I'm doing fairly well.
The Federal Reserve is doing a brilliant job of handling the economy, Mr. President, and that has damned little to do with you. But since you are the President, you get credit for all the good things that happen, and that's nice. But do remember, you will also get the blame for all the bad things that are going to happen. And some will remember that, because you just happen to be here. And the citizens out there think you can make the rain fall on their flowers and the sun come out for their picnics just by wishing it so.
You know, Jack, the chief of staff said after sipping his coffee, we really haven't got past the idea of kings and queens. A lot of people really do think you have that sort of personal power.
But I don't, Arnie. How can that be?
It just is the truth, Jack.
It doesn't have to make sense, it just is. Deal with it.
I do so love these lessons, Ryan thought to himself.
Okay, today is Social Security.
Ryan's eyes relaxed. I've been reading up on that. The third rail of American political life. Touch it and die. For the next half hour, they discussed what was wrong and why, and the irresponsibility of the Congress, until Jack sat back with a sigh. Why don't they learn, Arnie?
What do they need to learn? Arnie asked, with the grin of a Washington insider,
one of the anointed of God.
They've been elected. They must know it all already. How else do you think they got here?
Why the hell did I allow myself to stay in this damned place? The president asked rhetorically.
Because you had a conscience attack and decided to do the right thing for your country, you dumbass. That's why.
Why is it you're the only person who can talk to me like that?
Besides the vice president?
Because I'm your teacher.
Back to today's lesson. We could leave Social Security alone this year. It's in decent enough fiscal shape to last another 7 to 9 years without intervention. And that means you could leave it to your successor to handle.
That's not ethical, Arnie, Ryan snapped.
True, the chief of staff agreed, but it's good politics, and fairly presidential. It's called letting sleeping dogs lie.
You don't do that in the knowledge that as soon as it wakes up, it's going to rip the baby's throat out.
Jack, you really ought to be a king. You'd be a good one, Van Damme said, with what appeared to be genuine admiration.
Nobody can handle that kind of power.
I know, power corrupts, and absolute power is actually pretty neat.
So said a staffer for one of your predecessors.
And the bastard wasn't hanged for saying it?
We need to work on that sense of humor, Mr. President. That was meant as a joke.
The scariest part of this job is that I do see the humor of it. Anyway, I told George Winston to start a quiet project to see what we can do with Social Security.
Quiet project, I mean classified. Black. This project doesn't exist.
Jack, if you have one weakness as president, that's it. You're into this secrecy thing too much.
But if you do something like this in the open, you get clobbered by ill-informed criticism before you manage to produce anything. And the press crawls up your ass demanding information you don't have yet. And so then they go make up stuff on their own. Or they go to some yahoo who just makes up bullshit. And then we have to answer it.
You are learning, Arnie judged. That's exactly how it works in this town.
That does not constitute working by any definition I know of.
This is Washington, a government town. Nothing is really supposed to function efficiently here. It would scare the hell out of the average citizen if the government started to function properly.
How about I just fucking resign? Jack asked the ceiling.
If I can't get this damned mess to start working, then why the hell am I here?
You're here because some Japanese 747 pilot decided to crash the party at the House chamber 15 months ago.
I suppose, Arnie. But I still feel like a damned fraud.
Well, by my old standards, you are a fraud, Jack.
Ryan looked up.
Old standards?
Even when Bob Fowler took over the State House in Ohio, Jack, even he didn't try as hard as you to play a fair game. And Bob got captured by the system, too.
You haven't yet, and that's what I like about you.
More to the point, that's what Joe Citizen likes about you.
They may not like your positions, but everybody knows you try damned hard, and they're sure you're not corrupt.
And you're not.
Now, back to Social Security.
I told George to get a small group together, swear them to secrecy, and make recommendations. More than one, and at least one of them has to be completely outside the box.
Who's running this?
Mark Gant, George's technical guy.
The chief of staff thought that one over for a moment.
Just as well you keep it quiet. The Hill doesn't like him. Too much of a smartass.
And they're not? Swordsman asked.
You were naive with that, Jack. The people you tried to get elected, non-politicians, well, you semi-succeeded. A lot of them were regular people,
But what you didn't allow for was the seductive nature of life in elected government service. The money isn't all that great, but the perks are. And a lot of people like being treated like a medieval prince. A lot of people like being able to enforce their will on the world. The people who used to be here, the ones that Pilot fried in their seats, they started off as pretty good people too. But the nature of the job is to seduce and capture. Actually, the mistake you made was to allow them to keep their staffs. Honestly, I think the problem down there is in the staffers, not the bosses. You have 10 or more people around you all the time telling you how great you are. Sooner or later, you start believing that crap. Just so you don't do that to me. Not in this lifetime, Arnie assured him, as he stood to leave. Make sure Secretary Winston keeps me in the loop on the Social Security project. No leaks, Ryan told his chief of staff forcefully. Me? Leak something? Me? Van Damme replied with open hands and an innocent face. Yeah, Arnie. You. As the door closed, the president wondered how fine a spook Arnie might have made. He lied with the plausibility one might associate with a trusted member of the clergy, and he could hold all manner of contradictory thoughts in his head at the same time, like the best of circus jugglers. And somehow they never quite crashed to earth. Ryan was the current president, but the one member of the administration who could not be replaced was the chief of staff he'd inherited from Bob Fowler, by way of Roger Durling. And yet Jack wondered how much was he being manipulated by this staff employee. The truthful answer was that he couldn't tell, and that was somewhat troubling. He trusted Arnie, but he trusted Arnie because he had to trust him. Jack would not know what to do without him. But was that a good thing? Probably not, Ryan admitted to himself, checking over his appointment list. But neither was being here in the Oval Office, and Arnie was at worst one more thing not to like about this job. And at best, he was a scrupulously honest, extremely hard-working, and utterly dedicated public servant. Just like everyone else in Washington, D.C., Ryan's cynicism added. Chapter 6 Expansion. Moscow is 8 hours ahead of Washington, a source of annoyance to diplomats who are either a day behind the times or too far out of sync with their body clocks to conduct business properly. This was more a problem for the Russians, as by 5 or 6 in the evening, most of them had had a few stiff drinks, and given the relative speed of all diplomatic exchange, it was well into the falling night in Moscow before American diplomats emerged from their working lunches to issue a démarche or communiqué, or a simple letter of reply to whatever the Russians had issued the previous working day. In both capitals, of course, there was always a night crew to read and evaluate things on a more timely basis. But these were underlings, or at best people on their way up, but not quite there yet, who always had to judge which possibility was worse. Waking up a boss with something unworthy of the nighttime phone call, or delaying until the post-breakfast morning something that the minister or secretary ought to have been informed of right now. And more than one career had been made or broken on such seeming trivialities. In this particular case, it would not be a diplomat's hide at risk. It was 6:15 on the Russian spring evening, the sun high in the sky still, in anticipation of the white nights for which the Russian summer is justly famous. Yes, Pasha, Lieutenant Provolov said. He'd taken over Klusov from Shablikov. This case was too important to leave in anyone else's hands. And besides, he'd never really trusted Shablikov. There was something a little too corrupt about him. Pavel Petrovich Klusov was not exactly an advertisement for the quality of life in the new Russia. Hardly 165 centimeters or so in height, but close to 90 kilos, he was a man the bulk of whose calories came in liquid form, who shaved poorly when he bothered at all, and whose association with soap was less intimate than it ought to have been. His teeth were crooked and yellow from the lack of brushing and a surfeit of smoking cheap, unfiltered domestic cigarettes. He was 35 or so, and had perhaps a 50-50 chance of making 45, Provolov estimated. It was not as though he'd be much of a loss to society, of course. Klusov was a petty thief, lacking even the talent, or courage, to be a major violator of the law. But he knew those who were, and evidently scampered around them like a small dog, performing minor services, like fetching a bottle of vodka, the militia lieutenant thought. But Klusov did have ears, which many people, especially criminals, had an odd inability to consider.
Avseyenko was killed by two men from St. Petersburg. I do not know their names, but I think they were hired by Klementy Ivanich Suvorov. The killers are former Spetsnaz soldiers with experience in Afghanistan, in their late 30s, I think. One is blonde, the other red-haired. After killing Grisha, they flew back north before noon on an Aeroflot flight.
That is good, Pasha. Have you seen their faces?
A shake of the head.
No, comrade lieutenant. I learned this from someone I know in a drinking place.
Klusov lit a new cigarette with the end of its predecessor.
Did your acquaintance say why our friend Suvorov had Avseyenko killed?
And who the hell is Klementy Ivanich Suvorov? The policeman wondered. He hadn't heard that name before, but didn't want Klusov to know that quite yet. Better to appear omniscient. The informant shrugged.
Both were KGB. Maybe there was bad blood between them.
What exactly is Suvorov doing now?
Another shrug. I don't know. Nobody does. I am told he lives well, but the source of his income no one knows.
Cocaine? The cop asked.
It is possible, but I do not know.
The one good thing about Klusov was that he didn't invent things. He told the relatively unvarnished truth, most of the time, the militia lieutenant told himself. Provolov's mind was already spinning. Okay, a former KGB officer had hired two former Spetsnaz soldiers to eliminate another former KGB officer who'd specialized in running girls. Had this Suvorov chap approached Avseyenko for cooperation in a drug venture? Like most Moscow cops, he'd never grown to like the KGB. They'd been arrogant bullies most of the time, too besotted with their power to perform proper investigations, except against foreigners, for whom the niceties of civilized behavior were necessary, lest foreign nations treat Soviet citizens, worse, Soviet diplomats, the same way. But so many KGB officers had been let go by their parent service, and few of them had drifted into menial labor. No, they had training in conspiracy, and many had done foreign travel, and there met all manner of people, most of whom, Provolov was sure, could be persuaded to undertake illegal operations for the right inducement, which invariably meant money. For money, people would do anything. A fact known by every police officer in every country in the world.
Suvorov. Must track that name down, the militia lieutenant told himself as he took a casual sip of his vodka. Examine his background, determine his expertise, and get a photo. Suvorov, Klementy Ivanovich.
Anything else? The lieutenant asked. Klusov shook his head.
That is all I have uncovered.
Well, not too bad. Get back to work and call me when you discover more.
Yes, comrade lieutenant.
The informant stood up to leave. He left the bill with the cop, who'd pay it without much in the way of annoyance. Oleg Grigorievich Provolov had spent enough time in police work to understand that he might just have discovered something important. Of course, you couldn't tell at this stage,
Not until you ran it down. Every single option and blind alley. Which could take rather some time. But if it turned out to be something important, then it was worth it. And if not, it was just another blind alley, of which there were many in police work. Provolov reflected on the fact that he hadn't asked his informant exactly who had given him this new flood of information. He hadn't forgotten, but perhaps had allowed himself to be a little gulled by the descriptions of the alleged former Spetsnaz soldiers who'd made the murder. He had their descriptions in his mind, and then removed his pad to write them down. Blonde and red-haired. Experience in Afghanistan. Both living in St. Petersburg. Flew back just before noon on the day Avseenko was murdered. So he would check for the flight number and run the names on the manifest through the new computers Aeroflot used to tie into the global ticketing system. Then cross-check it against his own computer with its index of known and suspected criminals, and also with the Army's records. If he got a hit, he'd have a man talk to the cabin crew of that Moscow-St. Petersburg flight to see if anyone remembered one or both of them. Then he'd have the St. Petersburg militia do a discreet check of these people, their addresses, criminal records if any, a normal and thorough background check, leading possibly to an interview. He might not conduct it himself, but he'd be there to observe, to get a feel for the suspects, because there was no substitute for that, for looking in their eyes, seeing how they talked, how they sat, if they fidgeted or not, if the eyes held those of the questioner, or traveled about the room. Did they smoke then? And if so, rapidly and nervously, or slowly and contemptuously? Or just curiously, as would be the case if they were innocent of this charge, if not, perhaps, of another. The militia lieutenant paid the bar bill and headed outside. "You need to pick a better place for your meats, Oleg," a familiar voice suggested from behind. Provolov turned to see the face. "It is a big city, Mishka, with many drinking places, and most of them are poorly lit." "And I found yours, Oleg Grigorievich," Riley reminded him. "So, what have you learned?" Provolov summarized what he'd found out this evening. "Two shooters from Spetsnaz. I suppose that makes some sense. What would that cost?" "It would not be inexpensive. As I guess, oh, 5,000 euros or so," the lieutenant speculated as they walked up the street. "And who would have that much money to throw around?" "A Muscovite criminal." "Mishka, as you well know, there are hundreds who could afford it, and Rasputin wasn't the most popular of men. And I have a new name, Suvorov, Clementi Ivanich."
"Who is he?"
"I do not know. It is a new name for me, but Klusov acted as though I ought to have known it well. Strange that I do not," Provolov thought aloud. "It happens. I've had wise guys turn up from nowhere, too."
"So, check him out?"
"Yes, I will run the name. Evidently he, too, is former KGB.
"There are a lot of them around," Riley agreed, steering his friend into a new hotel's bar.
"What will you do when CIA is broken up?" Provolov asked.
"Laugh," the FBI agent promised.
The city of St. Petersburg was known to some as the Venice of the North for the rivers and canals that cut through it, though the climate, especially in winter, could hardly have been more different. And it was in one of those rivers that the next clue appeared. A citizen had spotted it on his way to work in the morning, and, seeing a militiaman at the next corner, he'd walked that way and pointed, and the policeman had walked back and looked over the iron railing at the space designated by the passing citizen. It wasn't much to see, but it only took a second for the cop to know what it was and what it would mean. Not garbage, not a dead animal, but the top of a human head, with blonde or light brown hair.
A suicide or a murder, something for the local cops to investigate. The militiaman walked to the nearest phone to make his call to headquarters, and in 30 minutes a car showed up, followed in short order by a black van. By this time the militiaman on his beat had smoked 2 cigarettes in the crisp morning air, occasionally looking down into the water to make sure that the object was still there. The arriving men were detectives from the city's homicide bureau. The van that had followed them had a pair of people called technicians, though they had really been trained in the city's public works department, which meant water and sewer workers, though they were paid by the local militia. These 2 men took a look over the rail, which was enough to tell them that recovering the body would be physically difficult, but routine. A ladder was set up, and the junior man, dressed in waterproof coveralls and heavy rubber gauntlets, climbed down and grabbed the submerged collar, while his partner observed and shot a few frames from his cheap camera, and the 3 policemen on the scene observed and smoked from a few feet away. That's when the first surprise happened. The routine was to put a flexible collar on the body under the arms, like that used by a rescue helicopter, so that the body could be winched up. But when he worked to get the collar under the body, one of the arms wouldn't move at all, and the worker struggled for several unpleasant minutes, working to get the stiff, dead arm upward, and eventually found that it was handcuffed to another arm. That revelation caused both detectives to toss their cigarettes into the water. It was probably not a suicide, since that form of death was generally not a team sport. The sewer rat, that was how they thought of their almost police comrades, took another 10 minutes before getting the hoist collar in place, then came up the ladder and started cranking the winch. It was clear in a moment. 2 men. Not old ones, not badly dressed. They'd been dead for several days, judging by the distortion and disfigurement of their faces. The water had been cold, and that had slowed the growth and hunger of the bacteria that devoured most bodies. But water itself did things to bodies that were hard on the full stomach to gaze upon. And these 2 faces looked like Pokemon toys, one of the detectives thought. Just like perverse and horrible Pokemon toys, like those that one of his kids lusted after. The 2 sewer rats loaded the bodies into body bags for transport to the morgue, where the examinations would take place. As yet they knew nothing except that the bodies were indeed dead. There were no obviously missing body parts, and the general dishevelment of the bodies prevented their seeing anything like a bullet or knife wound. For the moment, they had what Americans would call 2 John Does, one with blonde or light brown hair, the other with what appeared to be reddish hair. From appearances, they'd been in the water for 3 or 4 days. And they'd probably died together, handcuffed as they were, unless one had murdered the other and then jumped to his own death, in which case one or both might have been homosexual, the more cynical of the 2 detectives thought. The beat cop was told to write up the proper reporting forms at his station, which, the militiaman thought, would be nice and warm. There was nothing like finding a corpse or 2 to make a cold day colder still. The body recovery team loaded the bags into their van for the drive to the morgue. The bags were not properly sealed because of the handcuffs, and they sat side by side on the floor of the van, perversely like the hands of lovers reaching out to each other in death. As they had in life? One of the detectives wondered aloud back in their car. His partner just growled at that one and continued his drive. It was, agreeably, a slow day in the St. Petersburg morgue. The senior pathologist on duty, Dr. Alexander Konyev, had been in his office reading a medical journal and well bored by the inactivity of the morning when the call came in. A possible double homicide. Those were always interesting, and Konyev was a devotee of murder mysteries, most of them imported from Britain and America, which also made them a good way to polish up his language skills. He was waiting in the autopsy room when the bodies arrived, were transferred to gurneys at the loading ramp, and rolled together into his room. It took a moment to see why the two gurneys were wheeled side by side.
"So," the pathologist asked with a sardonic grin, "were they killed by the militia?"
"Not officially," the senior detective replied, in the same emotional mode. He knew Konyev.
"Very well."
The physician switched on the tape recorder.
"We have two male cadavers, still fully dressed. It is apparent that both have been immersed in water."
"Where were they recovered?" he asked, looking up at the cops. They answered.
"Immersed in fresh water in the Neva. On initial visual inspection, I would estimate 3 to 4 days immersion after death."
His gloved hands felt around one head and the other.
"Ah," his voice said. "Both victims seem to have been shot. Both have what appear to be bullet holes in the center of the occipital region of both bodies. Initial impression is a small caliber bullet hole in both victims. We'll check that later. Yevgeny," he said, looking up again, this time at his own technician, "remove the clothing and bag it for later inspection."
"Yes, comrade doctor."
The technician put out his cigarette and came forward with cutting tools. "Both shot?" the junior detective asked.
"In the same place in both heads," Konyev confirmed. "Oh, they were handcuffed after death, strangely enough. No immediately visible bruising on either wrist." "Why do it afterwards?" the pathologist wondered.
"Keeps the bodies together," the senior detective thought aloud. But why might that be important, he wondered to himself. The killer or killers had an overly developed sense of neatness. But he'd been investigating homicides long enough to know that you couldn't fully explain all the crimes you solved, much less the ones you'd newly encountered.
"Well, they were both fit," Konyev said next,
as his technician got the last of their clothes off.
"Hmm. What's that?"
He walked over and saw a tattoo on the left biceps of the blonde one, then turned to see...
"They both have the same tattoo."
The senior detective came over to see, first thinking that maybe his partner had been right, and there was a sexual element to this case. But...
"Spetsnaz.
The Red Star and Thunderbolt. These two were in Afghanistan. Anatoly, while the doctor conducts his examination, let's go through their clothing."
This they did, and in half an hour determined that both had been well-dressed in fairly expensive clothing, but in both cases entirely devoid of identification of any kind. That was hardly unusual in a situation like this, but cops, like everyone else, prefer the easy to the hard. No wallet, no identity papers. Not a banknote, keychain, or tie tack. Well, they could trace them through the labels on the clothes, and nobody had cut their fingertips off, and so they could also use fingerprints to identify them. Whoever had done the double murder had been clever enough to deny the police some knowledge, but not clever enough to deny them everything. What did that mean, the senior detective wondered. The best way to prevent a murder investigation was to make the bodies disappear. Without a body, there was no proof of death, and therefore no murder investigation. Just a missing person who could have run off with another woman or man, or just decided to go someplace to start life anew. And disposing of a body was not all that difficult, if you thought about it a little. Fortunately, most killings were, if not exactly impulse crimes, then something close to it. And most killers were fools who would later seal their own fates by talking too much. But not this time. Had this been a sexual killing, he probably would have heard about it by now. Such crimes were virtually advertised by their perpetrators in some perverse desire to assure their own arrest and conviction, because no one who committed that kind of crime seemed able to keep his mouth shut about anything. No, this double killing had every hallmark of professionalism. Both bodies killed in the same way, and only then handcuffed together. Probably for better and or lengthier concealment. No sign of a struggle on either body, and both were manifestly fit, trained, dangerous men. They'd been taken unawares, and that usually meant someone they both knew and trusted. Why criminals trusted anyone in their community was something neither detective quite understood. Loyalty was a word they could hardly spell, much less a principle to which any of them adhered. And yet criminals gave strange lip service to it. As the detectives watched, the pathologist drew blood from both bodies for later toxicology tests. Perhaps both had been drugged as a precursor to the headshots. Not likely, but possible, and something to be checked. Scrapings were taken from all 20 fingernails, and those, too, would probably be valueless. Finally, fingerprints were taken so that proper identification could be made. This would not be very fast. The Central Records Bureau in Moscow was notoriously inefficient, and the detectives would beat their own local bushes in the hope of finding out who these two cadavers had once been.
Evgeny, these are not men of whom I would have made enemies lightly.
I agree, Anatoly, the elder of the two said. But someone either did not fear them at all, or feared them sufficiently to take very drastic action. The truth of the matter was that both men were accustomed to solving easy murders where the killer confessed almost at once, or had committed his crime in front of numerous witnesses. This one would challenge their abilities, and they would report that to their lieutenant, in the hope of getting additional assets assigned to the case. As they watched, photos were taken of the faces. But those faces were so distorted as to be virtually unrecognizable, and the photos would then be essentially useless for purposes of identification. But taking them prior to opening the skull was procedure, and Dr. Konev did everything by the book. The detectives stepped outside to make a few phone calls and smoke in a place with a somewhat more palatable ambience. By the time they came back, both bullets were in plastic containers, and Konev told them that the presumptive cause of both deaths was a single bullet in each brain, with powder tattooing evident on both scalps. They'd both been killed at short range, less than half a meter, the pathologist told them, with what appeared to be a standard, light 2.6-gram bullet fired from a 5.45-millimeter PSM police pistol. That might have generated a snort, since this was the standard-issue police sidearm. But quite a few had found their way into the Russian underworld.
The Americans call this a professional job, Evgeny observed. Certainly it was accomplished with skill, Anatoly agreed. And now, first we find out who these unlucky bastards were. Then, who the hell were their enemies?
The Chinese food in China wasn't nearly as good as that to be found in L.A., Nomori thought. Probably the ingredients, was his immediate analysis. If the People's Republic had a Food and Drug Administration, it had been left out of his pre-mission briefing. And his first thought on entering this restaurant was that he didn't want to check the kitchen out. Like most Beijing restaurants, this one was a small mom-and-pop operation, operating out of the first floor of what was in essence a private home, and serving 20 people out of a standard Chinese communist home kitchen must have involved considerable acrobatics.